apologies for not remembering, so just to give out a few mistakes. As you know, some of the honorable members are leaving on Friday for Marrakesh for the climate change COP22. I understand that some logistics are still being worked on, they have not been concluded because last week the delegation there from various other countries quite a big delegation. Some members are still working on the flight and other things, but members will be informed as soon as the necessary arrangements have been finalized. Today we are going to receive a briefing on the Antarctica and as well as the briefing that we requested from the Working on Fire. So those are the only two briefings that we will be entertaining today. But honorable members, I must say that we meet here today amid very interesting developments in the country. On the state of our nation. Some very depressing, some very exciting. Last Friday, the 4th, the Paris Agreement came into force. It was celebrated throughout the world. I don't think we did much in here in South Africa to celebrate it. I've noticed that in Paris, what do you call it? That structure there that defines what Paris is all about was light in green. The Eiffel Tower. Was in green, signifying the coming of the force of the Paris Agreement. So it was celebrated the world over. The Secretary General of the UN, Mr. Ban Ki-moon, also held the ceremony to welcome the coming of the force of the Paris Agreement, which we ourselves have ratified on Tuesday. Unfortunately, South Africa was able to submit the instrument of ratification before the coming into force. The minister told us that I think it was on Wednesday. When it was on Thursday, that we were able as a country to do that, and they were certified and accepted. So we are proud family of nations now which have ratified. We can take our place now in the rightful place in the first meeting CLA conference of the party meeting
on Saturday.
It's a party to the Paris Agreement, which will take place in Marrakesh. So those are some of the things that are happening. But of course, we have got this other issues in our country, the public protector and the sport. This is the subject of the intense commentary by society at large. There is, however, one specific issue that relates to our committee, the SDG, that deals with the rehabilitation fund, which we have to follow up and make sure that as a committee will receive extensive briefing on that, because it's something that we worry about. things are going for the gym, to manage all this provision in place for rehabilitation and the internalization of fees. It does point out that the village, as a committee, we need to get closer to that matter and have an engagement around it. But otherwise, honorable members, you're welcome. Officials, everybody, DJ, or before that, we have received two written apologies. The minister will be arriving a bit late in Cape Town from Pretoria. She has some other engagements at site. I suppose she may not be able to attend the meeting today. The deputy minister also has apologized. She also finished a bit late yesterday. In her home province of KZN, so she had to take a morning flight. She might arrive a bit late to this committee. Honorable Mabilu has apologized. He's also got the RFA from Kimberley. He's also taking an end flight only arriving this morning. So those are the apologies for honorable members. I noticed Honorable Kekan is not here. She hasn't submitted an apology. I'm only referring to those members who are always attending the usual suspect. You're welcome. You're welcome, Honorable Shirabi. So those are the apologies that you have received. Of course, there's one outstanding apology from DG, can we hand over to you?
Thank you, Chair, and good morning, honourable members. We will start with the presentation on the Antarctica Treaty, covering both past and current plans, and possibly reflecting on the future plans, though those future plans have not yet been concretized with Cabinet in respect of the policy position for the future and the strategy for Antarctica. We will then have Dr. Mchepia Jonas taking us through the presentation. Over to you, Jonas.
Yeah, before that, I must welcome you, DG. I should have done that before. We know that you have been out of the council. So welcome back again.
Thank you, Honourable Members. The title of talk today is the Antarctic Treaty in South Africa. We'll look at the past.
Do you mind just keeping closer to the mic?
Okay.
They are not very audible. Lastly, I'll deal with
the possible opportunities and what we are currently working on. At the start, Chair, I was hoping that bring this overview and reminding us where Antarctica is in relation to the other continent. Antarctic is the coldest, driest, windiest, highest, and the least accessible continent. It has a population of 1,000 in winter, and in summer, around 10,000. It stores about 70% of the fresh water, and should the ice melt, it will definitely lead to a global sea level rise of about 70 feet. The nearest neighbors of Antarctic, the map there, are South America, obviously South Africa, Australia, New Zealand. The closest thing to America, where the distance between South America and Antarctica is 1,000 kilometers, and the distance between us and Antarctica is close to 4,000 kilometers. The same slide also is showing the five gateway countries, being South Africa, Australia, New Zealand, Chile, and Argentina. So all activities in Antarctica, they go through either one of those five gateways. And in South Africa, there are about close to, in the season, 7 to 11 countries that live from South Africa to Antarctica. Some historic perspective. In the late 1700s to early 1800s, the South Ocean explorers, the sealers and the whalers, they did claim part of the countries. They did claim for their countries part of the islands that they were discovering. And it was during the 20th century where people were now moving to Antarctic, exploring the Antarctic continent. And early explorers here include people like Captain Scott, Sir Ernest Shackleton, and the Norwegian Amundsen. And the main question that time was, who will be the first one to reach the South Pole? And it was on the 16th December 1911, the Norwegian was the first person to reach the South Pole. And a few days later, it was Captain Scott that reached the South Pole on the 4th of January. And during the period 1908 to 1942, seven countries laid territorial claim to the sector of the Antarctic. Those countries are UK, France, New Zealand, Norway, Australia, Chile, and Argentina. The UK was hoping that it could take part of the Antarctic as part of the British territory or the British Empire of the Commonwealth. And it did approach South Africa to lay claim, which South Africa did not do, as according to literature that they had financial concerns. And the then Prime Minister didn't see it or didn't see it. I must say that of all the seven countries that I've said they've made a territorial claim on Antarctica, there are four countries that recognize each other's claims for mutual claims. There are countries with over disagree, and those that are refusing to recognize the other claims, and of course USA and the then Soviet Republic then says they reserve their right for future claim. The following slide shows on the left where I am, what was proposed South African claim in 1981, which was eventually not taken by South Africa but later by Norway. And that is where the current situation is based on that proposed South African claim. And on the right, it shows the seven countries that have made claims. Important is to note that there is part of claims where countries' claims are overlapping, that is between UK, Chile, and Argentina. Their claims are overlapping. And also important to note is that there is also a part of the Antarctic that remains unclaimed. And at one stage it was the UK wish that maybe USA could make a claim that was never did. The political imperative that loomed after the world, after the Second World War, was a fear that the Soviet Union might occupy Manus Island. On the left is Manus Island in relation to South Africa. So the fear, therefore, was that maybe the US could establish a base and therefore become a center for whaling and use that base as a springboard to the south of, to as a springboard to the land that was proposed for South Africa to claim in Antarctica. And again, the other concern was around that PE and East London was within a rocket attached lift. So then Prime Minister Smart, so he fit them to annex the Prince Edward Island. The turning point for South Africa was when, in 1957-58, South Africa was invited to participate in the Commonwealth Transatlantic Expedition as part of the celebration of the International Geophysical Year. This led to South Africa participating actively and also establishing a research base, later having a year-round staff station. And it was as a result of the success of this International Geophysical Year activities and the Cold War competition between US and Soviet Union, the fear of militarization and conflict and nuclear weapons testing in the South Pole, and also the conflict as a result of countries that have made territorial claim on Antarctica, that has led US in 1958 to start negotiation, and that led to the adoption of the Antarctic Treaty. So those are the 11 countries in the middle that were the original signatories, include the seven countries that have already stated that they've made a claim. On top of that is Japan, USA, nuclear weapon testing and dumping of radioactivity. It then says the continent Antarctic is free to carry out science, meaning that scientific work, science is currency. It freezes all those claims that the other countries have made. And it says there will be no military activities allowed in Antarctic. And that continent has to be used for peaceful purposes only. Then the fifth one is to promote the Antarctic as a place for doing scientific work, encouraging other countries to be part of the treaty. And only way to be acceptable is what it is. In addition, there are four agreements that now all of them are normally called the Antarctic Treaty of 18, which includes agreement for the conservation of Antarctic flora and fauna, which was later on superseded by the Protocol on Environmental Protection, which I'll talk to you later. The other agreement is the conservation of Antarctic seals, which stops the hunting for seals in Antarctica. The other agreements are the conservation of Antarctic marine living resources, and this agreement seeks to control all the fishing that is taking place in the Antarctic waters. And lastly, the Protocol on Environmental Protection, which was one of the stringent and toughest that has ever been made in the world, where any activities in Antarctic are subjected to environmental EIAs. In 1988, the Convention on Regulation of Antarctic Mineral Resources was developed, but that was never taken into force because there were pressures from internally. Australia and France, being part of the treaty, canvassed strongly to stop that regulation because it was not explicitly stopping or prohibiting exploitations of minerals. And there were also external pressures from NGOs in the non-treaty countries, e.g. here in Malaysia, that were very, very strong in saying that that convention should go ahead. In fact, in the United Nations General Assembly, countries like Malaysia wanted the treaty to be part of the UN system and not to be existing on their own. And were also vocal about the treaty, including the South African government today, because of the apartheid system. The Convention of Regulation of Antarctic Mineral Resources was then superseded by what we call the Madrid Protocol. The protocol seeks and prohibits mining, exploitation of minerals until 2038. And it says that any overturning of that prohibition will require a majority of 75%. Meaning that you can only do that in 2048 if there's a majority of 75%. And I must say that in this year's Antarctic Treaty meeting, all countries have committed themselves to the venue of the exploitation of minerals in Antarctic. With that, Chair, I close the first part where it deals with the history of how we got to have this Antarctic treaty system. In short, as long as the treaty system exists, there will be no military activities in Antarctic. All the territorial claims that those countries have made are frozen, and there will be no new country that makes any new claim to that land. So as long as the treaty is in force. I now move over to the current international and national environment. We currently see interest in Antarctica. Countries that were non-original treaty members have increased their bases in Antarctica. Examples here are China, South Korea, and India. Really increased activities in Antarctica. And Iran and Turkey have also indicated their intention to build bases in Antarctica. And we've seen elsewhere countries that have austerity measures, e.g. UK and Australia, they are currently building their new polar research vessels. They have cut elsewhere, but they are not coming to Antarctica. And other countries have renewed their strategies. Examples, Australia, Russia, Norway, just quite recently presented their white paper on Antarctica specifically. And elsewhere, we're seeing disputes over proposal for new marine protected areas and the anti-whaling groups and Japanese government over whaling in that part of the world. The question that always arises is this just science or might there be other issues? That is just a snapshot of what I've just said, and that seeks to demonstrate some of the investments in the Antarctic, some of the countries that have really increased their investment even under austerity measures. And coming back home, we realize that we do not have a comprehensive national Antarctic strategy. A strategy that could encompass economic interests, our research interests, foreign and security interests, and etc. Our national research strategy, to a large extent, is not guided by what are our current interests. And we've also observed that our outputs are not on par with our treaty countries. In fact, it's as a result of there are quite a few top scientists, hence you have to grow at the rate of the few. Institutional arrangements, role players have different objectives, no synergies. So what are the proposed future plans? We see possible opportunities in three areas. One on foreign policy, other one on science interest and economic potential. I'll talk briefly to all the three in the next few slides. The current slide seeks to remind us of all the countries that are part of the Antarctic Treaty. The blue are those that are called consultative parties, and the brown are called non-consultative parties. They are all part of the Antarctic Treaty. What needs to be noted there is the grey. And the grey is predominant in Africa. So South Africa is still the only Africa. Even at the continent being the closest to Antarctica, we still find ourselves the only country that is part of the Antarctic Treaty. And hence the need for a greater representative from African countries. Africa has been left behind. The other opportunity or interest is the science interest. They would say the current government has really made huge investments in the program itself. You have the state of the art based in Malmo, in Sinai, that is in Antarctica. one month too late. But the question is, are we really getting those investments to give us a result? I'm saying that we're not fully utilizing the investment. And what could be the root cause would be the fragmentation, the lack of coordination, the playing together, and responsibilities and commitments of stakeholders in the government part. What we're proposing is that we really need to come up with a business case that tries to close the gap between the investment and the benefits. And looking at various models in delivering that. This is the institutional arrangement in international. What we find is that a lot of international programs, they all strive to have their activities planned into one institution, one company. For example, if you look at Australia, all Antarctic-related programs are under a branch called Antarctic, Australian Antarctic Division. And if you go to Germany, all the activities around Antarctica are under an institution, same as UK, same as CHI. So there seems to be a convergence in one place. And in South Africa, that is the fragmentation I was talking about. There are various stakeholders. The Department of Environmental Affairs that's looking after the logistics. The Department of Science and Technology that looks at finding the science. Department of Public Works that looks at the maintenance of the bases. Department of Defense, where we normally use their doctors. And their co-workers are leading the delegation to Antarctic treaty meetings. So there's quite a lot of fragmentation and no mechanism of coordinating all this. The other part of the statement that we've identified is that we are, South Africa is very close to an important part, or is very close to Southern Ocean and Antarctica, which are very, very important part, because Southern Ocean is one of the major carbon sink and has vast marine resources and great potential to life prospective. Being closest to this important part, I don't think we are utilizing that closeness, our closeness to this important area. And what we see as the cause would be the limited resources and skills, limited numbers of renowned scientists. And if you've got few, the country is just going to grow at the rate of those people. And what we're proposing, and we're starting to work on already, is long-term partnership with countries living from South Africa. Last week, Thursday and Friday, we were with the Norwegian delegation, purely looking at possible collaborations going forward. Now, the other part which we think is of importance is the gateway status of Cape Town. That needs to be enhanced and be found in the other countries. We're proposing and thinking around the creation of Antarctic Center, which will provide enormous scope potential for the awareness of this. As we all know, that not so many people or South Africans know anything about it. So, hoping that a center like that could also assist in creating job and skill generation at an early age, and also emphasizing South Africa's commitment to this part of the world. And we're saying that we're already there. I mean, the branch Ocean Code is the VNA. The VNA existed by close to 4 million people. So we could leverage our presence in the country of being in Antarctica, not so many people would have been if they would be able to go to Antarctica. So at least if they could have a place where they could have a feel of what it is to be in Antarctica. And also provide necessary information and education. We've seen that type of work in the village. We're also saying that we need to establish a South African cooler network, which could then serve as a one-stop shop. Say about 7 to 11 countries that have been from the government. The one-stop shop could assist in the coordination and making life easier to those countries that have been from it and have a generational economic into the South African GDP. And we also say maybe we could have African Forum, and we say that an African Polar Institute, and there it does not necessarily have to be around the coast, it can be an inland. And what we're also saying is that in Antarctica you don't just have to do the science, you could also expand that and look into the polar law, polar politics. You know, there are other opportunities that are there that could be explored in universities. Just put the University of Montana, just demonstrating that that type of work can be done easily. And that is the South African Polar Network coordinating all the cargoes, all the activities, the logistic work in and around the gateways in Cape Town. So, what are we doing towards this comprehensive Antarctic strategy? We have finalized the economic potential of South Africa as a gateway to Antarctic. We're currently working on the Antarctic strategy, looking at understanding and crystallizing what is or should be our national interest in Antarctic. And thereafter, once we've got that, the strategy will then also be in a position to then say what should be the institutional arrangement that could drive those sort of the national interests. With that, back to David.
Thank you.
So that's the next part. It won't be in detail, just on the high level. Thank you.
You must introduce your delegation.
Oh, Ashley Naidu is going to take us through the presentation.
He's
the Chief Director of Research in Options and Costs. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Ichi. I have a few slides, about half a dozen, just to give you an overview of the extended continental shelf chain. To understand the extended continental shelf chain, at least two slides of history as well. It all starts with the primary document that all countries in the United Nations system use to manage the open ocean. And that is the United Nations Convention of the Law of the Sea, UNCLOS. It was negotiated throughout the 1970s and concluded in 1982, so Africa was signed early in the 1990s. And this really sets out the rule, what's allowed in the oceans and the processes for multinational governance in the ocean areas. UNCLOS, United Nations Convention Law of the Sea, allows countries to claim what is called an EEZ, or zone of about 200 nautical miles. And 1 nautical mile is about 1.8 kilometers, so it's roughly times 2. So South Africa, from where the land ends and the ocean starts, still claims another 400 kilometers straight out into the ocean, where those resources belong to South Africa. So what does this mean, exclusive economic zone? So 400 kilometers from the coast into the ocean, each coastal state, in this case ourselves, South Africa, can claim whatever resources are on the water, in the water, on the seabed, and under the seabed, is for the exclusive sovereign rights of that country to use. So 400 kilometers, so when you go the next time to the coast, look out, 400 kilometers, still everything in there is what South Africans can use, solely for the use of South Africa. So UNCLOS goes further than the 200 nautical miles, or about 400 kilometers. It also allowed coastal states to claim an area beyond that 200 nautical miles, and this extended claim is called the extended continental shelf. So if a country can prove that the landmass, in this case the southern African continent, is continuing into the ocean beyond that 200 nautical miles, you can then claim some area in addition to the 200 nautical miles. And I'll show you a map on the next slide as to how far this can go on. So in the extended continental shelf, the 200 nautical miles plus the extended area, countries can still use those resources for their sovereign rights. But there's a small difference. Whatever is in the water column, whatever is swimming, is not the sovereign right. That still belongs to international countries or international regimes, and I'll explain that later. But whatever is on the seabed and under the seabed belongs to the sovereign use of that country, if you can prove that it's still part of your continental shelf or the landmass that's going into the ocean. So what this means is that the fish that are swimming in this extended area cannot be used for the sovereign right of the country. And this is mainly talks to the big tuna fish that swims throughout the world's ocean. Historically, there are some countries, China, Japan, and European countries, Spain, Portugal, that fish these tuna throughout the whole world. They follow them and fish them the whole year. And for the last several decades, the United Nations have set up regional fisheries management agencies, like the Atlantic Tuna Association and the South Indian Tuna Association. And the countries together then manage these tuna. They're very profitable. They fish the year round, and the fleets follow them the whole year. And there was this existing arrangement to manage tuna species, primarily tuna species, and they do not want to interfere with those. So the extended continental shelf allows whatever's on the seabed and under the seabed. So it's mainly mineral resources, oil and gas. This is a map of showing a few things. The first dark line, the red line, that's run along the coast is the current exclusive economic zone, the 200 nautical miles, or about 400 kilometers that South Africa can claim and has claimed at the moment. The white line, both around the coast and around Prince Edward and Marion Island that Dr. Pepe spoke about, is what South Africa in 2009 has claimed to say, we think that the extended continental shelf extends to those white line areas, and we'd like to claim all of that ocean as extended continental shelf, which means that South Africa will have sovereign exclusive rights to whatever is on and under the ocean floor in the white area. That's our most optimistic area that we'd like to claim. And it shows that South Africa could double what is currently under the exclusive economic zone. There are some figures on the bottom right hand side of the slide to show that South Africa's total area claim will be just under 2 million square kilometers. So the extended continental shelf claim, or the white, the area within the white lines, is led by the Petroleum Agency of South Africa, and they submitted this claim in 2009-2010 based on a series of surveys, ocean surveys, that they've done on the rocks and geology of the area. As the Department of Environmental Affairs, we sit on a multi-department steering committee that meets once a year, generally in the first 3 months of the year, to look at progress and how different departments can work together to support the claim. The claim is supported in, is submitted in two parts. The area around South Africa, as the coastal mainland area, and there's an area around Prince Edward Island as well. And both of these were submitted in 2009. Next to South Africa, on the screen, is another island, the that's Prince Edward Island. France owns the islands next to us called the Crozet Islands. So South Africa and France submitted a joint claim for this area around here. All claims have to be submitted to the United Nations, the Office for Legal Services, and there's a process where through the United Nations, scientific review panels are set up to look at the evidence the country submits when it puts in the claim of the extended continental shelf. So these specialized scientific review panels may reject a claim in full or award it in full, or they may award a claim in parts depending on the scientific evidence that's provided. And it all depends on how a country demonstrates through geology surveys of the continuation of the continental shelf. At the moment, South Africa's review term was in 2015-16. We're hoping that the panel will make a recommendation on the claim by February or March 2017. 2 weeks ago, when I checked with our colleagues at the Petroleum Agency, they say they are confident about the majority of the claim area for South Africa, but there is one area in particular where the scientific review panel has raised some issues that there's insufficient data, and that area, I'm pointing out on the screen, is the area between the Agulhas Plateau and the Mozambique Ridge. So this area here is where the scientific panel is saying the data is inconclusive. So more data may give us an answer either way, to say it's definitely valid or that it's definitely invalid. So I just wanted to say that, because getting more data may not mean that we just get it. It may prove that there is not a extension of the continental shelf. Beyond that, the Petroleum Agency is confident about the majority of the claim. Thank you.
Thank you, Ashley. Thank you,
Chef. Before, did you explain the Petroleum Agency? Who constitutes this?
It's the DMR agency, the Department of Mineral Resources, has got a public entity called the Petroleum
Agency
of South Africa, PAFA. Their offices are here in Cape Town.
So it's the entity of
DMR? DMR, yes. It used to be under DME when DMR was together with energy. So now it's under. So it performs functions for DMR and also for Department of Energy, but with the MTRDA amendment, it also seeks to harmonize the functions and the link to the Department of Mineral Resources. So that is the entity. I think honorable members, I just thought I should then say that in essence, the presentation, both presentations by Dr. Mpetla and Ashley Naidu, Dr. Naidu is right here, the DDG that leads the team. The key message is that we do have neighbors in the ocean that are different from what we have in the continent. So France is our neighbor, for example.
And
Norway on the Antarctica, and Germany. So those are our neighbors. So when we work with them, even in a geopolitical context, we also have to bear those cooperation requirements in mind. the whole Antarctica program is being relooked also within the context of the ocean economy. And basically the minister was saying if she was here, she would have wanted us to then reflect that link in that context. But I understood the honourable members had received a full presentation on the ocean economy, and there was a key question about what is the plan for South Africa in respect of Antarctica. Are we going to develop a policy or the strategy? And what are the balancing forces in that respect? So we have outlined the importance of Antarctica and or the Southern Ocean, both in the context of our climate management or in respect of carbon dioxide absorption, in respect then of being able to influence climate patterns in the region and elsewhere. And the more data that gets collected there by scientists, the more we contribute to the world globally around knowledge and information, and especially in respect of resources as well as in respect of climate and climate changes over time. So that is the significance then of the presentation. And there is cooperation with those departments, particularly science and technology contributes. We have, when we present our financials, we normally indicate the CFO how much we get from the Department of Science and Technology for the research work. But the most expensive part is also the logistics, which is where we've been spending a lot of our budget as a department, because we move people from Cape Town, scientists from various universities and other academic institutions that are not even based in Cape Town, and the weather services and some of the atmospheric scientists that are based at the University of Pretoria and other places in the country. So it's still a very strategic area, and I guess when the minister has then taken through the strategy or the white paper to cabinet, we will then be able to present factually then what has then been resolved as our way forward into the future in respect of our activities in Antarctica. And lastly, we also shown Mr. when Dr. Mpetia was reflecting the slide where it shows on page 12 South Africa's investment, which shows Gore Island on the left side, which is a United Kingdom or UK island. That island, currently we have our weather station, and South African Weather Service has got staff that operate from there. There is a proposal to migrate from that island to another island, and it does affect us, but we are still exploring the negotiations on whether we should remain in Gore Island or then move to the new site that the United Kingdom has identified. But my colleagues can further expand to that. Are you fine, Dr. Mpetia? Okay, so we can head over.
Okay, thank you very much. Welcome to the station, colleagues. Welcome, honorable any takers? Honorable Edward?
I've got two questions on the first presentation. The one is on the slide, which one, but it's on my page 2, the one that says current South African context as well. Basically everything that explains that the other countries are putting their Arctic into a basket, if I can put it that way, and we've got all sorts of different baskets, which makes it very complicated. The question sounds simple, but I understand that it's much more complex than that. But is there any way that you maybe can guide the committee into saying, well, how do we get there? How do we say, instead of saying, just give it to one department or one, how do we, from where we are, get to where we want to be, if I can put it that way, or even just start getting there? Getting into the in the right direction, because I can only imagine it would be pretty frustrating that you've got quite a load of army departments. And then another one is just tongue in cheek, rather. Two slides before the one that I just spoke about, it says that all these other countries are all of a sudden showing interest. This is a, I'll get the name now, but anyway, it's a dream. What is your thesis? I mean, it can't just be science. All of a sudden, all at once, it's a little bit much bigger, I don't know, in my, too much of a coincidence. So if you've got any guesses or answers as to what else, and what the implications could be for us and our research, I mean, because we've had pretty big stuff there, you know. Thanks,
Jack.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think the DG has just come up to me when she said she would draft the strategy for the Antarctica, which all of my questions are based around the strategy, and how these Antarctica, if you are able to claim the part that you want to claim, to extend our EEZ, or how is it going to play in the operation Barkita or in the ocean economy. I think the DG has covered me on that one. But really, have we done any favors? If we're going, if we get successful in claiming the better EEZ, do we have done any specific, like the spatial marine planning, and what are the resources that are we anticipating to get in that further EEZ? How is it going to contribute to our Operation Pakisa and the spin-off thereof? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chairperson. I wanted to welcome the two presentations and also to thank the information that they've given us. But only one question. On page 8, that's talking about the mineral exploitation project for until 2048. I just want to know what is the rationale for saying that mineral will be prohibited until 2048, and what will change to enable mineral exploration on the Antarctica after 2048 on Mars? Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. So those are the only questions. Yes. Maybe just to, what is the likely scenario post 2048? What is the current thinking? Whether there will be further prohibition or the 75% of the countries wishing to do exploration will then be entertained. I just want to understand what is the likely scenario. Whether there is any possibility that there could be such a move by countries to respect the sense to start the mineral exploration. But it's also an issue of the play. How long do you think the issue of federal claims will be entertained post 2028? Thanks.
Okay, should I start then allow the committee to come in? If honourable members, Firstly, I think that we are doing the best we can currently with the coordinating activities. If I may say, when we had the old SA Agalas, the determination has got probably more better institutional memory than myself. We recall that we were together with Fisher. And so some of those activities were then coordinated within environment and fisheries to a greater extent, but and also working with science and technology. We then went on, during the macro organization of the state, to ask the question, do we then keep this function with environmental affairs or with science and technology, for example, because the National Research Foundation, NRF, had a program that aligns to this work and that builds on this work. At the same time, we're also exploring the role of the Biodiversity Institute standing. So there are still areas of research in that respect. We have not quite concluded that. But we did confirm that for now we can still coordinate the functions within the department and enable those cooperations with the various institutions and including the Department of Science and Technology. So the Department of Science and Technology was not keen, for example, because whoever takes the function also has to deal with the logistics, the hard part of maintaining the base and managing all of those activities, and it's not easy, and you can't just leave it there. It has to happen to enable the scientific work that is required over time. We, as environmental affairs, also the other branch, the legal authorizations, compliance and enforcement branch. They send their scientists, which are the EIA specialists, to go and assess the environmental impact. So we have data that gets collated and we analyze the footprint of the activities that are taking place there. So they very much environmental protection responsibilities, research and applied science aspects, and also the other related functions in terms of ensuring that maybe we can do more in promoting the area from a tourism growth perspective. So there are economic activities that we have not quite thought through well and aligned. So there are opportunities within the context of the operation package for us to then package those and still coordinate within the department. And if we have a future institute, we will still not be able to take over functions of other departments, as you may know. So it does not quite resolve the issue. So as government, we have to capitalize on cooperative government provisions to enable the harmonization of those activities and alignment. My other comment on the other question about, I think I'll leave that to Dr. Maiki, so whether it really is it just about science. There is, though, a growing acknowledgement of the role of the sea or the ocean in the world, strategically both in terms of transportation or movement of goods, as you know, and that's well articulated within our ocean economy framework, and other, and so it is already understood that more than almost 70% of the world economic activity happens at sea, and in the past, I think that was not quite emphasized. So I would think that contributes a bit to the interest that is growing with other nations in terms of getting themselves where it matters most. Part of what is not just only about the islands, it's around our coastline. If the Suez Canal, somebody was talking, were to close, because that's also possible.
Mm-hmm.
South Africa is going to be a very important hub for the world shipping activities and movement of vessels. So there is, there are politics also, and I think because the treaty itself committed that if those, the particular Antarctica is a peace island, I would say an area where there is peace, there must not be any war activities assumed. My sense is that even post 2048, the prohibition of mineral exploitation might still pertain. But again, I think, Chair, we would have to then say we have not done the modeling yet with those countries. So we have to coordinate some modeling of the maybe two, three options. Options where you continue with the status quo, an option where you have other activities. What are the possible impacts and outcomes? And then another scenario where you have a hybrid of sorts. So we may have to get into that, but we have not started engaging on that modeling work. So those scenarios are not available. I'm just making my own kind of assessment. Let me hand over to DG.
Thank you, DG. I will attempt to address the question on what people are interested in. I met one delegation that I won't name, who told me that there is no difference between geological research and mining. So what they're doing is geological research. But it was quite clear that they would go beyond just geologists from the point of view they are interested. We also had a delegation from Norway last week, and they are very strong on catching krill. For
example,
krill.
Fish out of
it's
a fish out of that.
Catching krill.
It's a 4 to 6 centimeter shrimp-like animal. So the closest thing we have to is a prawn or a shrimp. But they're occurring millions of times around Antarctica.
And it is expected that it will become very, very important in terms of formation of various compounds, medicine, and so on and so forth. So some delegations, some countries like Norway and Russia are very big on krill research. And they are also big on other resources such as Patagonian toothfish, crabs, and so on. And it can be said that South Africa is not participating as fully as the other countries. Especially the newcomer countries I mean, don't mention them. they are big on using fish resources. DG, as far as 2048 is concerned, I tend to see more like you do. But we need to say, they are not saying the moratorium goes away in 2048. Only they will consider. So it's not like the process will go on. And I do not think they will get 75% to remove the moratorium. I may be wrong. Thanks. Honorable Khadev has asked about resources that we expect to be able to exploit in the expenditure. My quick answer to him, Chair, to Honorable Adebe, is that South Africa has not yet explored fully the current 200 miles for a variety of reasons. But of course, if now we've got additional sea space, when we do explore, we're exploring 400 kilometers instead of 200 miles. So there is a great opportunity, but we cannot at this time say it will be plant X and so on and so on.
That my understanding is that the 400 kilometers, the easy that you are able to claim, you can do fishing as well, but the extra 200 miles, you can't do that. So that will be mostly for to explore some
oil
and other resources from the sea.
And the pharmaceuticals.
Okay, any other person who wants to respond?
I was going to ask that you also explain the whaling and the whaling in Antarctica.
Whaling?
Yeah.
In the recent International Whaling Commission meeting, there was a proposal that was supported by South Africa to create a whale sanctuary in the Southern Ocean. And that, of course, was opposed by the normal opponents, Japan, Norway, and so on, who opposed it, and we lost. So that the whale sanctuary has not been established. But it's quite a polarized organization, the National Whaling Commission Chair, where you've got two sides that do not want to agree on anything. And the Japanese, therefore, will continue to do what they call scientific research and catch whales. Southern Ocean, they get harassed by the NGO each year. But it just doesn't seem possible for us to get peace between the two groups.
I think, Chair, the key issue for those members is that South Africa has got a policy of not supporting whaling. So there is anti-whaling and whaling. So we don't necessarily subscribe. We don't subscribe to catch to the catch, which is contradictory to our scientists' normal sustainable use position. We've always
Said don't
to fly the way the catching of whales.
Catching of whales.
We don't, and I think, guys, we can explain another time why. We can come back and give you a proper briefing on what informed that position. So we then tend to be polarized in the different, for example, in Antarctica, there is the presence of whales, the seals and all, and the position is that those must not be caught. But I think they continue to do research that advances the argument that we should enable that activity. It's a matter that we must also bear in mind, and particularly with the new entrants or the people that have got the new interest in the area, they are the parties that also subscribe more to that whaling activity. Thanks, but we can come back with the comprehensive.
I see
Honorable
Makubela, you said after, I thought the time was done. I want to wrap up at 11. So I've got another presentation which may take us a while, but it must be done by one. So if you want to forfeit
honourable members, we only have one opportunity to ask the response and so unfortunately it passed because there was no hand. But I will allow the resident to make a comment.
Sir, I just want to get two things first cleared. Africa, in the slide that we have put there, is not playing a role.
Mm-hmm.
What are we doing with that? You know, because we can't just leave it and just be happy that we are participating. And Africa as a whole, it's not doing anything. Antarctica is very big. It's said to be bigger than Europe. It is double the size of Australia.
Mm-hmm.
And it cannot be that. Africa is always not there. But the second thing, we think our participation or involvement there will grow at the rate of our scientists or the kind of investment that was made. When are we upscaling this investment and when are we concluding the strategy itself? Because that's what will give us more impetus in terms of participation there and mobilizing everybody, including the other departments,
mm-hmm.
to understand what we should be able to do. And just lastly, are we now the leading department or who's leading in all those departments that are doing this? Are we just coordinating with the lead department in ensuring that something happens at the pace that perhaps the country needs?
No, the question time is fast. So I thought the week was going to be a comment. Unfortunately, time does not allow us to take more questions. So allow me to surprise you.
It was a very, very important question.
Unfortunately,
later after.
Unfortunately, you did not raise your hand when you were raised. Because we do one round and then we get a response and then we summarize. So, we will note it for the next interaction on the ocean, because I think we need the DG and Dr. Baikis. I think we need to have quite detailed interventions from the economy. So on the ocean. Both for members' understanding and appreciation of the work that you're doing in the ocean, but also for some issues that the members might be having. For instance, the need for the strategy. For me, it's something that is long overdue. I mean, we have got how many years of presence in the Antarctica? Many years of presence.
Yeah.
And yet we are still grappling with the need for us to develop a strategy.
Yeah.
Which probably is something that we should have been having by now. It's a very good progressive idea, but I think something that is long overdue. So, that's in summary. So, I think we note the presentation, we note the good work that you are doing as a department there in implementing this treaty. And we hope that very soon you will come and brief us on the strategy. That's, I think, is something that we need. What the strategy will talk to the future role, the levels of investment that we need to make and further expansion of the presence, because I think that is also what is important. We are the only African country there, but there are other new players whose presence is over a period of time. It might be owing to the level of resources and the economy, because we talk
China, they've got sufficient resources to be able to invest in scientific research, for instance, and therefore expansion in the Antarctic. So we will find time, Honorable Member Babilu, we'll find time to engage. And hopefully when we do find that time, we must raise our hands and ask questions. For now, thank you very much for the presentation. I think we are ready for the next one. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you, Chair. And Trevor is going to take us through the presentation and on the Canadian report. And then we have Dr. Murray to also come in on the finances. If you recall the last time when we sent us back, we wanted a detailed presentation or report on the Canada situation, which is provided now. And we're also going to just indicate who are the other funders, the other departments that contribute to work on file. And that report is going to be presented to you. So over to you.
Yeah, I think, thank you very much. You know, the normal practice is that we get documents prior. So this one we're only going to receive it now. The secretary is telling me that there was another document which was filed in. But when I look at this one, it can't be filed in because of the file.
Well,
12 pages can be filed in. It has got 12 pages of the presentation. And then there's another 15.
Chair, there's a narrative. I think you asked for a narrative and then the presentation. And they were, when I was away, I saw them on email. Already on Wednesday last week. They were not submitted on time.
Chair, I think it's Trevor's presentation that was originally a 39 megabytes that we couldn't email, and then we made a low resolution, but that was submitted last week already.
Submit that to where?
To the DG's office.
Well, Chair, sorry, I apologize for that. I'm not aware what the problem was. The document was sent on time, as far as I know. At least I checked when I was away on email, and I saw it. So my assumption was that it has already reached the Secretary. So I apologize
for that. Get the documents.
Okay.
You see what normally happens, is that we get the documents prior. So that if there is a need to follow up on something, we do that before the meeting. Because now we might be receiving things for the first time. If there is something that we need to follow it up for, it's not possible. So we say, no, go back and come back again. It's a waste of the time and resources. But I hope in future we will improve. Please get the documents beforehand so that we read through the documents and we come here prepared. I don't know whether you want to comment, but I saw your hand on the cabinet. But I want us to break for maybe 3 minutes, just a body break, comfort break, actually. Come back. Do you want to ask a question or make a comment?
No, thank you, Chair. I wanted to comment because we normally have quiet and nice structured meetings
in our portfolio, we don't sort of like fight, but now it like keeps on happening that we don't get documents before, so that we prepare thoroughly. It's been happening, I'm noting it. We always get the document, the huge big document which we haven't had time to go through. And I will plead with you, Chair, that to ask the department to forward us the information before it. Sometimes we get the information on Monday at the 11th hour. You really can't be able to prepare early for the meeting the following day. So I'm pleading with you, Chair, that I don't want us to sort of like be seen as if we are in conflict with the department, but that's my plea.
In the department, please let's do that. Let's send the information to the station. At least the basic form, so that members can also do their research and follow up. And also for us, normally what we do, the researcher, we don't have a researcher now, but the content advisor knows, so we are making it. Or on an overdrive.
He's
doing everything for us. So sometimes you may want him to check something for us to advise the committee. So it's important that we get information well in advance so that we don't get information when it's coming in.
No, it won't happen again, Chair. I honestly, for Tuesday, I signed off and I'm told that people will withdraw the document. Well, the minister needs a day or two also to go through this, because she wants to sign off on the document. So I think then there must have been a mishap in between those, in that process. But definitely, you know, my plan is definitely not to, I normally have documents ready Tuesday, so that by Thursday they are already circulating.
All right.
Apology
accepted. Can we break? Have a control break and then come back at the say 11:15.
I'm not sure we got the right place. When we did research,
only one.
But did you see the photo?
Does
it look like?
I haven't taken the picture yet.
Just look at the back. Just at the back.
Oh, yeah. It's opposite. It used to be.
Because you see, we do order that you see, you know, like a
big
order.
They don't pay too much attention, you know, and we've actually been doing it. Yeah, we're doing it. We say, look, if you want to deliver the basics, we have to do it.
That's what I'm not like saying they must have
basics. Yeah, no,
it's not
there. No, but it's not basic.
Thank you. Yeah, what's that? Yeah, I'm going to be asking. said that, well, let's meet at the Congress in September in Durban. and we can therefore proceed with a bilateral agreement to allow for such an exchange. Before we could actually get to Durban in 2015, the fire situation in Canada got out of hand, and they then made a request for immediate emergency assistance, and we did surround an interagency agreement and a 2015 operational plan. So at that time, we sent 49 firefighters with three management people for 30 days. They were deployed in Alberta and British Columbia. And our firefighters were actually rated amongst the best in the world of all the international parties were there. And I give you a copy of what one of the kind of report sheets will be. And I just want to sort of highlight some of the small text there, what it says. And it says, by the time the SA team got to the fire line, the 3,000-hectare fire was at the mark of stage. The South African team was great in adapting to our tactics and standard operating procedures. They were alongside the Mexicans for the transition day and worked well together. Their high fitness level and good morale helped on the fire line. Their duties included locating hotspots, required substantial amount of digging to extinguish. Some crews walked over 7 kilometers a day while finding hotspots. It was a pleasure working with the South African strike team. Thanks for the hard work, and I hope to see the Africans come to our birthday again. This was on the 18th of August. Just to give a sense, and this is a sample of the feedback we got of that first team that went out at that point in time. Those firefighters also received their home salary plus the Canadian allowance per day of $50 Canadian. And when they came back with those earnings, we had reports of firefighters were able to complete building houses, funding further education, and one actually even started his own business from those earnings once they came back. In December 2015, Dr. Murray and myself and Ms. Charlton participated in South Africa Canada Binational Commission, which is the commission which meets each year. And as part of the environmental sector, we agreed to expand our cooperation in fire management. And particularly, we said that the lessons we learned from the first deployment is that some of the equipment they're using is not what we use yet. So Canada agreed to send us some trainers with equipment to train our firefighters if we do need it in the future. The 2016 Canadian deployment was preceded then by a training camp in April where they had Canadian instructors which gave us experience in the use of the Canadian hose and pump equipment and general fire readiness. We actually put some 394 firefighters through that program, and we developed an operational plan between the agencies of working on fire, subsea, Alberta and British Columbia governments. Now, very important, and I'll come back to it, I think a lot of the issues that were raised around the finance. The deployment, these operational plans allow for a flat rate. A flat rate, which I'll come back to explain what it means per firefighter. And also, the initial agreement was for two rotations, 14 days on, 3 off, and then there would be a recession. So in total, we were making a commitment for some 34 days. The Fort McMurray disaster, of course, attracted quite a bit of attention, reporting in the world some 90,000 people were to be moved. The damage in terms of hectares were extensive. At one time, the fire line extended what would be from Johannesburg to Cape Town. It was a huge fire. It was a disaster fire. Even impacted on the oil price, because part of the area affected was the oil field there up to the north of Fort McMurray. So on 20th May, we received an urgent letter requesting 301 personnel. We then brought those people who had been trained, 301 of them, to a staging camp in Magaliesburg, where the firefighters signed an addendum to their current employee contract, which indicated they would be getting this allowance of $50 a day. And we had our Deputy Minister of Environment Affairs and the Canadian High Commissioner give them a send-off. The 294 firefighters and civil management, which departed on the Air Canada chartered flight from Oro Tambo. I'd just like to reiterate, Chair, in terms of the conceptualization of it, that this overseas deployment is seen as emergency overseas assistance, not unlike when we had a tsunami relief in 2004, when we had earthquakes. What we mean by that is that personnel who deployed in those circumstances are there to deliver emergency assistance. You remain in the employ of the sending country, in this case, South Africa. And in most cases, they receive by your sending country. And your overseas allowance is not necessarily related to host country wages. Of course, a convert, if they were sent to a very poor and low-income country, you can't actually peg your allowance to those particular rates. In the case of the WAF allowance of $50 Canadian a day, which obviously appreciates with the currency of the two deployments, approximately 600 Rand a day in 2016. And that was in fact pegged to a SARS tax-free allowance that all the civil servants, when they go abroad, they can consult what it is. So in the case of Canada, if I'm not mistaken, at that time it's about 167 Canadian dollars a day, and if you extract minus the accommodation and the food, you'd actually come to the Canadian $50 a day as the additional allowance. I think just to illustrate the fact that we have an emergency assistance scenario, not a job creation in a foreign country. Working fire is not a labor broker. The visa that these firefighters got was a VX1 visa, which is very explicit in that it does not allow such people coming to Canada be integrated into the Canadian labour market. It's very explicit. So we've had three deployments so far. The one that I spoke about in July to Canada. We also sent a team to Indonesia in November of 2015, and then of course the May-June deployment which we are talking about at the moment. Now, let's come back to the flat rate issue. What the operational plan allows for is a flat rate is essentially all the costs divided per head. Now, within a team that went abroad, you had different levels of firefighters. You had crew leaders, you had strike team leaders, but you average it out to an average cost. So for all the crew, the flat rate was 172.88 Canadian dollars a day. And for the management, it was more because that rate also had to cover the domestic salary. We couldn't expect the South African government to be paying their salaries while they're actually being deployed abroad. Now, this agreement anticipated covering all the costs, so that includes their remuneration, domestic, the overseas allowance, their insurance, the comprehensive medical, personal, and death insurance, the mobilization, demobilization costs, supplies, in other words, at the camps, in terms of the food, transport, and all other supplies that were relevant to the preparation for this deployment. And you'll see in the document that we provided, the map, we've drawn firefighters from every single province. There were 9 provinces represented. So even for the training, when they had to come together, there was quite a bit of extensive travel that they needed to do. The training costs, as well as all the management local travel, and personal protective clothing, again, we could not expect South African government to be paying for these items which is related to the deployment. And we also had to allow for an incidental and contingency component because it was a large deployment. We've never deployed that many people. And in firefighting, the variables change. You can never fully predict what the cost structure would be. So we just like to reiterate, Working on Fire is not a profit-driven organization. Any surplus from international deployment is credited to the WAF program to expand its program of work. The management fee, as it is allowed in the contract, is defined, and the maximum is defined at 9.6%. There is no loophole for the company that's implementing this to somehow get any further benefit. Of course, the inaccurate reports that we saw about firefighters being getting $21 Canadian per hour was never part of any negotiations or agreement with the Canadian authorities. Our total deployment, as I've indicated, was for 294 at a flat rate of 172.88 a day, and 7 managers at a flat rate of 450.15 a day. That was what the budget was agreed on. However, that is not necessarily the final figure because in terms of the operation plan, the final figure will be subject to reconciliation at the end of deployment, and we are only paid 3 months after the return of the firefighters. 85% is paid, and then the remaining 15% with 3 months thereafter. Again, this is seen as being part of the international collaboration. collaboration around emergencies, and it's quite difficult because no country can assure that it has all the capacity to cope with emergencies. Even the United States, in their fire situation, they draw on the Mexicans, they draw on the Canadians at times. As you'll see in the Canadian situation, we shared work there with Mexicans, with Americans, USA citizens, with Australians, and with New Zealanders. Now, all WAF personnel, while they were deployed, received their South African salaries as per the normal payroll at the end of the month, and the $50 per day for the other country allowance from the day they were mobilized till the time they returned to their bases. Now, if we look at what this means in real terms, the current expanded public works stipend today translates into about 9.17 Canadian dollars, 110 a day. That's the average. Right. When they're away from home base, they also get an allowance, which is another 5.83. The out-of-country allowance would be $50. So, in effect, they had the equivalent of about 65 Canadian dollars per day during the deployment, or 780 rand. Now, if we break that figure down and see how it came out of the total amount per day, the flat rate, if we take the $65 a day, plus we had to adjust for some of the crew leaders, which are a little bit more, 48% of the budget went into the pockets of the crew. When we paid all our various suppliers and worked at $50 a day, so that was another 29.4% of the budget. We kept a 15% contingency in terms of any costs that we could not anticipate. And in terms of the implementation fee, it was a mere 6.9% of the total budget. And that's how we came to the flat rate of 172.88, which was agreed on for 34 days. Our management, of course, was at the 415, and there were 7 of them for the 34 days as well. Now, I think it's important to understand what the purchasing power issue is here around this particular arrangement. While the WAF personnel were there, all the board and lodging was paid for in Canada. They were accommodated, fed, completely. In fact, I'll talk a bit more about the location. Essentially, the overseas allowance would be spent when they come back home. Okay? In fact, when you look at the facilities where it was out in the wilderness, as we drove there, Bongani and myself, we went for black bears, brown bears, coyotes. It was out in the wilderness. There wasn't much to spend on anything. I understand in the facility you could buy cigarettes and some basic toiletries if you wanted to. So when we compare the purchasing power, and this is quite important to understand what happened to our firefighters' results, they actually earned more than their Canadian counterparts. Now let me just demonstrate this. If we look at what our firefighters actually received in rand terms, 26,519 for the period. This is what typically in EPWP, because Expanded Public Works is a poverty relief initiative. This is what they would get normally in terms of money. The Canadian, of course, in rand terms would receive 38,000 rand. But if you take an internationally agreed methodology of calculating your cost of living, in other words, your purchase parity, your Canadian would actually be having the equivalent of 20,000 rand purchasing power out of their income, because the cost of living there is more expensive. Right? So our South African firefighters did not do too badly after this entire operation. Of course, when they came there, they were very well received. You had the Premier Justin Trudeau welcoming there, the newspapers were absolutely ecstatic about the service, and incidentally, we had reports that we encountered where even the Canadians were telling our firefighters, please work a bit slower. You're just a bit too fast. We were obviously showing them what we could do, but by their standards, we were exceeding the pace. Now, where did this whole problem come about? I think the issue started with the media reports which indicated that firefighters were supposed to receive $21 per hour. Now, it was published in the Toronto Globe and Mail on the 2nd of June, and EMCA had an interview with the Highest Commissioner of Canada on the 3rd of June, and behind the voice of the station announcer announced that the salaries are increasing from $15 an hour to $21 an hour. Now, there was never $15 an hour, and it certainly wasn't $21 an hour. I did approach the editor of EMCA, Anton Harbert, who actually confirmed to me in writing, as you'll see in the narrative, that they discovered that the journalists hadn't checked their facts. They were had engaged in disciplinary action, and the journalists who actually reported on this received the final written warning. Of course, our firefighters, one of the facilities they had where they stayed, they had Wi-Fi, and they looked up on the internet and YouTube, saw these reports, and they demanded clarity from the local WAF management. I think one of the issues that we will highlight is that we failed to counter the media reports timelessly. When this report came out on the 2nd and the 3rd, it was only on the 9th that we categorically tackled the issue that the report is absolutely false. I think some of our Canadian workers who we worked with also encouraged our firefighters to go for more. And one can speculate, you know, what the motive is for that. They might be in solidarity with their fellow workers, or they might be a bit uneasy about the workers coming from abroad, but nonetheless, it's very clear record of the Canadians also saying, look, go for it, what you see in the press here. Our local management could not contain the discontent amongst the firefighters, and unfortunately, the Alberta Premier, who is a very well-respected Labour person, the first time we had a Labour Party government in Alberta for a long time, and she's got a long track record of involved in labor issues. But she had an elected conference that weekend. And here you had this discontent in a province, and she misread or was misinformed of the situation, said, look, these guys must be paid by our rates. Notwithstanding that they actually are emergency workers, they're employed by a South African company. And the protocol internationally on emergency services, you remain the employee of your sending country. So our local management gave our firefighters off on the 8th of June, and I want to reiterate that there was no strike. We have not encountered any evidence of a strike being initiated. We do have a very clear report that the WAF management, the local management, gave the day off to try and just resolve the matters, because what they've organized is for that director of CISI to come and address them later that day on the 8th. So when he did address them, the situation had improved. In fact, on the 9th of June, the United States firefighters had been demobilized. When I arrived there, certainly the Mexicans were on their way out. So the fire situation had improved by the time the director addressed them. And he, in the course of his engagement with the firefighters, announced that the WAF contingent would also be demobilizing at that point in time. As I've indicated, the other international teams have also been demobilized this time. The Minister of Environment dispatched a mediator in my person, as well as Paul who accompanied me. And our mission was very simple. Explore options for further deployment, and if not, ensure the safe return of the firefighters. As I said, the fire had been turning down. There was no fires in British Columbia or elsewhere to go to. We left Alberta on the 13th of June and arrived safely in South Africa on the 14th of June on the chartered flight back from Canada. All the funds due to the firefighters were in their accounts by the time they arrived in South Africa. And we have currently submitted an invoice to Canada for this deployment. And as the invoice is exactly as the initial agreement. 294 firefighters at a flat rate of 172.88 for the 20 days that we have now. Now, the Premier intervened as the Premier of Alberta, and she says, look, give them $21 for the day they've worked. So for 6 days they worked, so they got $21 an hour, because that was the erroneous report in the media. And we billed them for that, and obviously have to credit on those days they don't get the $50 that were part of the 172. And the seven management at 450 for 15 for 20 days, we billed them for that. So that's the invoice we sent, and then a into the WAP program, and as just a matter of history, in 2015, 1.7 million went into the program. In Indonesia, 567,000, and we're anticipating about 1.2 million from this deployment. In terms of the management fee, in the 2015 was 638,000, Indonesia 500,000, and we estimate in Canada 1.7 million. So that's a very clear framework. There's no company who's working with a whole lot of money away from this deal. As I indicated last time, we gave you a table which had been seen by our auditors and signed off by our auditors for the case of Canada 2, obviously being estimated. What are the lessons we've learned from this? This was our largest deployment in South African history. We had incorrect media information on the firefighters' pay, which was really the spark of the discontent. This was public information, and I think what we didn't fully appreciate is that the delay in responding, that even if families got to see this, and of course large amounts of expectations were created, people did their calculations. I think everybody knows about the exchange rate, how to work at what their sons and daughters were probably coming on with. But there's no reality to the contract they signed up. We had a critical failure in not mounting a timeous and strong media rebuttal. As was indicated, between the time that the media reports came out, and the second and third, we only had a rebuttal really on the 9th of June. This allowed the misinformation to gain traction among the firefighting candidates, and was certainly complicated by local Canadians who cut in to demand the increase as published in the media. As you see, the Premier herself eventually just said we'll pay that amount of money. Our local management was unable to counter such media reports, and the big lesson is that our future deployments must have a coherent and responsive media strategy. We can't go on a public stage. We didn't anticipate the kind of media coverage that we got. I mean, I think most people have seen the scene when they arrived in Alberta at the airport. It went viral. Right? We even had a former Conservative Premier of Canada who said, you know, he stood up for Mandela's release at the time when we had the Thatcher Reagan nexus, and he was the one Conservative Premier who broke from that for Canada. And he said, this is the link with our struggle, the struggle in South Africa. So everybody got on the bandwagon, it was a big thing, but we need to have a coherent media strategy. I think the other thing we learned from this is our WAPS Canadian management team was not sufficient or adequate for so large a team abroad. We should have had much more diverse managerial team, both in terms of skills and makeup of the team. In our provincial units, we've got HR personnel, we've got social development personnel, we've got payroll personnel, you know, with the soft skills. Here we have a team of 300 people only being managed by a skeleton operational team. I think from our side also we need to put in a greater effort of canvassing and explaining deployment contract to firefighters for them signing before they go on this disaster emergency relief deployment abroad. We need to re-emphasize the channels of raising concerns and grievances, and also reiterating that our disciplinary code, which we're very proud in terms of our structures, it's a very, one would say, a military-style operation, because in the fire situation, you need command and control. You can't have debates about what to do with your leaders in those situations. The way forward, even though the Canadian was a deployment in 2016 was a third, it was far larger than we've been used to doing. And there are a number of areas which we plan to improve our preparation, including finalizing the interstate agreement, and I think here we'll talk a bit more to what progress has been made on that front, enhancing our governance from our board's oversight of this type of planning, better management planning and assignments of management personnel that we need to have, as well as creating a responsive communication plan to accommodate such deployments, and an enhanced induction process for firefighters deployed so they understand what the terms and conditions of this deployment. We have, in fact, Mr. Chairman, received indication that Canadians would like to plan on drawing on our resources in the future for 2017. So I don't believe the situation has been damaged irreparably. I think they also, the management in Canada, understood a very difficult situation to manage where you have media reports contradicting what the local manager is saying to people. And then, of course, the Department of Environment Affairs is busy with should indicate that during myself and Mr. Labati's visit there, our High Commissioning candidate, Mr. Shepherd Madlana, was party to our meetings that we had there. Thank you very much from my side. I think that's as good as a summary I can give on the narrative that you submitted. And I think the Department of Environment Affairs could probably fill in also on the progress we made in terms of the inter-country agreement. Thank you.
Okay. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair, and all of the members. There is also a document today that outlines the program. But in summary, South Africa has no formal agreement to date. The process is subjected to the DELCO bi-national process. We had, since 2003, South Africa had some arrangement between the country and the Canadian Foreign Affairs Ministry. And that has led to what is referred to as annual consultation meetings between the two countries. They take place once a year. So it's still a kind of cordial relationship that is not formalized at a higher level. And that is why in 2015, when the meeting took place in Canada, December, I delegated Dr. Murray to represent the department at that bilateral meeting. So subsequently to that, because the minister had instructed that we then followed through with DELCO, a formalization of an agreement. We have had two bilateral meetings, both through the technical working groups within DELCO and also within South Africa as the Department of Environmental Affairs, because any MOU that we sign with countries does not focus on one aspect. So the working on fire is one component, but then there is a broader program. And that process is not fully under the control of the department, it's under the control of DELCO. So we are ready with the concept that then facilitates that agreement, but we are waiting for the formal meeting to take place. And we're informed in October that it is not planned for this before the end of this year. The meeting is planned for April next year, but it's not yet even confirmed in terms of the date. So technically, the negotiations around what is composed within the agreement are done, but we still have to have those negotiations under the formal process of the court to then ensue in April next year, and thereafter it could then get to ministerial level and even to the state level. So that's where we are, Honourable Chair. Thanks.
Thank you. You earlier on indicated there's a package on the finance.
Yes.
Okay, someone that.
Thank you. Dr. Murray is going to take us through the presentation.
Was it loaded on the computer?
Okay.
I was apologize earlier on I had to step out of the room. There was an agent to fucking call that I had to take.
Well,
they can locate me in the room.
And not find you in the room.
Please don't cry.
It's a coffee show. So it's a slide presentation chair that has the title Working on Fire. Overview and explanation.
Yeah, we're quite.
Okay.
Dr. Marek?
Good. I think it's about 1 minute to afternoon. Good morning, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members. I'm just
you
going
can
to
can quickly do the final shout.
Yeah. I'm just going to give you a quick overview. It wouldn't take too long. This is just a map, and I'm going to. I just want you to remember the picture. The dark areas are the areas that's fire prone in South Africa, and fires occur naturally there. And this is a map of where our teams are deployed. So you can see we pretty much cover the whole country where one would expect fires on a regular basis. The next map is a map that we did drawing a 100 kilometer radius circles around each center that we've got people stationed. And you'll see that the fire-prone parts of the country has been covered by the whole, by the program. The next slide is an interesting one in what kind of people do we support. Now, you'll see that the light blue slice of the cake, that's the Department of Forestry Plantations. The red one is communal land. We are, over the last few years, have extended significantly. Then game reserves and national parks. But the bulk of the land is private agricultural land across the country. This is just a picture of the deployment of our resources. We've used the person days of employment as the proxy to show how the resources are being deployed, and you'll see that KwaZulu-Natal has got the highest number of people deployed, and Northwest has got the lowest. And as I've said in the previous meeting, we are still trying to improve in that. Now, here we come to the financial overview. And I've given you 3 years of full financial overview, the first year before the current contract came into being. Then 2014-15 are the two full years finished already. And then we've given you a forecast of where we're on our way to with 2016-17. As you'll see, the department's EPWP allocation went up from 420 to 513, 556, and then to 558 in 2016-17. Our partners and participating departments, other areas, that's the Gauteng projects, Gauteng provincial projects. The Medupi project is a partnership between the department, Eskom, Marion Roberts and Basil Reed, and then Sasol projects and the Ethekwini projects. That went up from 7 million to 22, and then only 12 in 2015-16, but this year again we're planning for it to go up. Then with regards to the additional third party, this is short-term deployments of our teams. That went up, that was 30 million in 2014-15 when we started reporting on that in the new contract, 35 million in the next year, and this year we're hoping for it to go up to 81 million. And then lastly, and I'm not going to stand on it too long because Mr. Abrams has already indicated the unlocking of third-party resources in international engagement. This is just a image of the third-party resources unlocked versus the departmental contribution. So as you can see,
that there is still substantial potential for the unlocking of third-party resources. This image shows what the money is being spent on. Over the years, the direct employment costs has been consistently above 50%. The indirect employment costs, these are things like protective clothing and so forth, is consistently around 20%, and then overheads is between 6.1 and 7.8%. I don't think you should read too much in the year to date, because you buy things and your costs vary quite significantly during the year. And our aviation has been consistently between 6 or between 7, effectively 7 and 8% over the last 4 years. And as you can see,
aviation, what does it mean?
Aviation, that's the aerial support, helicopters, the spotter planes, and the water bombers.
It's for the rental or for the...
Yeah, the rental. And then lastly, the management fee, as you can see, the forecast for 2016-17 is 9.6%. That's where the implementing agent gets the funding from. Now, just to give you an idea, the UNDP recently funded a project in the Eastern, Western and Western Cape on integrated drought and forest fire management. And in that study, it was shown that 55% of all resources deployed by or on integrated crop and forest fire management was working with fire resources. 36% came from land users, local authorities 6.5%, 1% from provincial government, and 1.5% is from national government. That's, I think, the same parts contribution. Now, this is not necessarily representative of the country, Mr. Chair, because the Western Cape is relatively well supported by its provincial and local institutions. And when we get into the historically disadvantaged areas, the percentage, we expect the percentage of the working on fire contribution to integrated health and forest fire management is most probably 70 to 80% plus. This is just the employment that we've created. I'm just going to conclude with a few high-level important indicators. And you'll see that there's consistently been a difference between the number of person days delivered and the number of person days planned according to budget, and that can be ascribed to the unlocking of third-party resources. The cost per person day, again, the planned versus the cost, actual cost per day per person day can again be ascribed. What we do is we calculate the cost per person day against the money that the government spent, the Department of Environmental Affairs spends on those person day costs. This is what we're being employed for. We're always saying the expanded public works programs are, the managers are employed to employ, and this is one of our critical indicators that we're looking at. The next one is the number of training days, the accredited and non-accredited training days, and you'll see that the accredited training days is generally a little bit less than the non-accredited training days, as the capacity for training is much easier, the process, the institutional arrangements are much easier. The number of fires attended over the last few years, 2013-14, you would see that it wasn't a very big year in terms of fires, but 2014-15 was a disastrous year. It was after a wet summer, high biofuels or biomass loads in the field, fuel loads, and then during the dry 2015-16, you'll see there were actually less fires, and one would expect there to be more fires during the droughts, but there are actually less fuel loads in the landscape. The estimated hectares of fires that burnt again there, you can see in 2014, 15, and this is very unpredictable, Mr. Chair. One can get some predictability out of it, but you have to have the resources available, and as we could have seen from Mr. Abrams' presentation, the Canadians, their demands outstrip their resources. The size of the fires, the average size is basically a mirror image of the size of the total size of the fires that burnt. And then this is where we come, the preemptive work that we do. Fire breaks made, and again, you can see this is gradually increasing over the years. We're trying to increase the number of what we call prescribed burning. We read the fire breaks, and our next one, and the next one coming after this, fire breaks, hectares of manual clear to reduce fuel loads, and then prescribed burning, the last one. We're trying to maximize that. That's to optimize the use of the time of the firefighters. And these prescribed burning very often also makes a contribution to the clearing of invasive alien plants. We burn invasive alien plants in this process. Just briefly in conclusion, Honourable Chair, we have made significant strides against unwanted fires in South Africa. In that process, we're employing more than 5,000 people in integrated health and forest fire management, and 30% and more of them are females, higher than any other fire agency in the rest of the world. From that slide, that famous fire study, it's clear that if working on fire disappears from the scene in South Africa today, integrated salt and forest fire management will have a severe impact, negative impact. However, we have to admit, as Mr. Abrams has already shown in the deployments, there is still room for improvement. And we still want to grow the capacity in our resource-poor areas. If I had more time, I could have shown you some maps on the levels of degradation in the old historical, the homeland areas, and a lot of the natural resource management program's emphasis now is on improving the productive potential of land in those areas. The direct cost of employment is, as I've mentioned already, is consistently 50% and above of total expenditure, but we need to improve the enabling environment to unlock third-party resources still more. Governance can improve as long as as long-term institutional arrangements are developed. And that's it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you very much. That's the report for our members. Question? Question?
Page number 5 of the slide package. Somebody say there was an inaccurate media report about the payment. Just trying to find out if the reason why they had to give an accurate report, whether it was intentional or was just an innocent mistake made by those media houses. Please, I don't understand why. Thank you.
Thank you. Honorable Edward.
Thank you, Chair.
think I'm a little bit confused. It just goes me over the page from page to page. Sorry. Okay, basically, I just quickly before I ask questions, I need to ask a question for clarity. In one of the slides, it says that there's 49 firefighters and 3 management level guides, I can put it that way. Is that for the previous deployment? It's not for the one that everybody's freaking out of. Okay, cool. I'm just checking. Okay, then my page 4, I'm sorry, I don't know which slide it is, it says operational plan. Is it at all possible, and if it's not, it's fine, where it says that the CIFSC working on fire contract covered all the anticipated costs and reduced your costs? Why I'm going to ask this question is because when we spoke last, it seems that there's a big gap in what certain people perceive and understand, etc. So when you say, sorry, this is 50 Canadian dollars, people say, oh, but you've got 50 times that amount or whatever on a weighted effect. So is there any, I looked at some of the financials, as far as I can understand, remember I'm a woman also for the financial system. But it doesn't give everything. So, okay, that's one of the questions. So, if it is at all possible for like the cost, the figures, etc. If it is in the thing, maybe just point me to it, then I just misunderstood somewhere. Then on the next page 5, it says that the, but it's on other pages as well, where the figure never formed part of the agreement. And on other pages it mentions that you've spoken to the reporter or the boss of the person that reported. Is there any specific place that we could figure out where it came from? Because it's a very random number. It can't even be a mistake that someone heard something and it's just... are we looking into where it came from, clothes, etc., etc.?
What are you referring to now?
The media said, wrongfully, that the guys wanted, Canadian dollars per hour. Where we say 50 a day. Am I correct? Yeah. So then he explained that the media guys are taking action against their reporters because they didn't do research. But then that, what is she, Premier, also climbed on the bandwagon, and that's kind of where, sorry for the pun, but everything went up in flames. Because everything was kind of okay until the Premier got involved and it became this very political thing. So my questions are silly, it's just in my head I'm trying to make sense of where it came from, etc., etc. Okay, so the Premier was misinformed of Alberta, I've got a name now. I didn't know that she was up for re-election though. A lot of things make a little bit more sense when you have her background. But did we do anything from our side to correct the misinformedness of herself or whatever you call it? Because I mean, she kind of did a lot of damage to our guys. They look, you know, people look up to our firefighters, our working firefighters. Right. I only read one, my last one, I'm sorry. I'm talking with Fly because I'm struggling three. I only read one media statement from Working on Fire. Please don't see this as being me. But I think it was a very weak response. I didn't even need that feedback, but in my personal opinion, I think we could have handled it better, yet we learned from it. And I love reading the slides on what we've learned and we rectify, etc. But I think that's kind of why I, for one, wanted a full report, a full presentation, because a lot of the things were, by myself, misunderstood because of the perception that was created by media, etc., etc. I'm sorry, Jeff, because I took a lot of time.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? The parties were passed. On the other side, people will start walking to the station, to the bus station when the bus is already reached the destination.
You know, for me, I think now what a greater challenge. At the end, because our firefighters were mobilized by their counterparts in Canada to say, fight for Ipalama, and that's making the premier fight pay as if or whatever, and they ended up giving the $21 that was there. There were some precedent has been cost to say each time they go out they are likely to earn like their counterpart. Now to change that, I take it is to then up whatever agreement that will come now a precedent has that to say it's possible, it could be done. I'm just saying, whatever the arguments before, it could have been something else, and they might have gone there and been understood how they're going to be aiming. But now, once they're in that environment, they were mobilized otherwise, they understood, and now that's what they ended up getting. So, for you to come back and say, this time around, we're changing that whole setup, it's like, we are fighting, but the sooner the agreement that DIA and DELCO is to finalize, I think the better, so that before the next engagement, at least there's something that everybody will have understood, even the other country will be understanding the protocols around around that. But to Chair, the management fee in page 7, in terms of the last presentation, happened to change from 11%, almost 11.5% to 9% over the coming years. The expectation would have been that they needed to increase. Yet in this case, they actually went down. Any explanation for that as to what could have happened and so on? The last point that I needed to raise here, this model that we're using, was it researched? Is it the best practice? Where was this? I know it may not be a thumbsack, but I don't want to ask the question that but how did we figure it out that it works for us, you know? Or it's only that some smart fellow or clever person decided this would work and we just followed it because we had no other anything to compare with, you know? So that we know
which was that.
The model that you are utilizing in terms of the engagement. Yeah, in the one that we use.
The one on deployment.
Yeah.
Or the the model on which you were fired.
That works also internally.
Okay.
The model on fire works also internally.
Okay.
And I'm saying, even particularly when we go out and utilizing that model in terms of how we interact with another country, is it being researched or what is it like? Because all I'm saying is they've got their own models they are utilizing. Any country that will engage with us in a particular agreement, they will be using their own scientifically worked out model, and I'm checking with our own.
Okay.
Yes.
So I
can
say,
thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think this one is directed to the department. I remember on our previous discussion we raised the issue of the legislation that enabled the department to establish the Working on Fire as the entity of the Environmental Affairs. I remember something was called Act 63 of 1970, which is the Mountain Catchment Act, which when you go and look at it, it points to DAF or fisheries. There was other legislation that was also was put forward which speaks to the disaster management, which doesn't fall within the responsibility of the Environmental Affairs. I'm not saying Chairperson is the best thing to do these projects, which are meant to give job opportunities to the unemployed youth in the country. It's a good thing, but we need to ensure that whatever that we do as the department, we've got the applicable legislation that is enabling the department to continue with such good moves of creating employment opportunities in the country. I just want to clear this out, Chairperson. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Yeah, I think this time the report is quite detailed,
mm-hmm.
which is what was supposed to happen in the first place. I think you should have known that after having that experience, when you come to the portfolio committee, there will be questions asked about that. So you must appreciate the fact that the report is the same,
mm-hmm.
but it should have been done in the first place. Because I'm sure you appreciate the fact that the Canadian deployment of the working for fire personnel there did some damage to South Africa's international standing and reputation, particularly in terms of perceptions around how we treat labor relations. Because they might not, you know, how this thing was brought about and how it caught the attention of the media, international media. The narrative that emerged from there was that we are mistreating our own. There's a narrative that you mentioned from it. But also this $50 paid to the workers vis-a-vis the amount that we get, that we received, or we're supposed to receive from the Canadian, which is It also fits into that narrative, because when you get 50, subtract 50 from 172, you know, it doesn't even make 50%. So what was reported is that this is how much money you are getting, 172, this is the amount of money that you are paying the worker, 50. Without probably taking into account the fact that there's some administrative costs and so forth.
Mm.
I just want to find out, you know,
what formula was used to come to this 50 of the 162? Because it does create a serious difference. In fact, when I look at what you are going to, or what the administrative, what do you call it, administrative or management fees. What the management fees was to be as a result of this deployment, it takes you to about 1.7 million. And the previous one, the 2015 one, there was just over 500 or 600. I'm trying to look for the exact slide.
Slide number second box.
What slide number is that?
It's right at the end, Chair, just
no,
before
no,
the way.
Slide number 19, Chair. In Mr. Abrams' presentation. Titled Overseas Deployment at the Top. Any surplus?
Yeah. Overseas deployment. Canada it was 638, Indonesia 500, the estimate now for 2016 is 1.7. So when one looks at this thing, one would sort of ask the question, why such a substantial increase between the first one and the second? It may probably be because of the personnel that was employed there, but does this have a relationship with the amount of money that was paid to the worker? So I'm saying that narrative might find traction when we look at the figures. But isn't it not the fact that there is still less, therefore, that has to be increased in the management fee? Yeah, so those are my questions. But I think generally, as part of way forward, not for waiting for fire, we have to get a presentation on all working for programs in the department, so that you know, we may not find ourselves in a situation where we hammer one program, but you may find that the principles are applicable across all the working for programs. So even when I'm asking these questions, I'm giving it preliminary because I think we need to get a presentation so that we can compare what is happening across all the working for programs so that we can then have the global view. But for now, those are the preliminary questions that we have, and probably I think as part of going forward, we might have to organize an oversight either maybe next day when you come in. Ms. Abrams? Yes, sir.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Honourable Shalemi, I think the question you raised was quite pertinent. As I've indicated in the narrative report, we've got written accounts from the editor of ECNA. And that was a very powerful bit that the firefighters saw, because they know the High Commissioner. The High Commissioner has seen them off. But very subtly they put a voice behind it to announce that the firefighter salaries had increased from $15 to $21 an hour. Now, there was never $15 an hour. There never was $21 an hour in any of the negotiations. So, you know, as Mr. Harbour says in the email to me, the easy investigation, the reporter could not demonstrate where they got the information, where they checked. There was a report in the Toronto Globe and Mail, and that was a joint report between someone based here in interview and someone based in Canada. And one doesn't know what was actually at play in terms of them trying to put costing to what the firefighter should be paid. So I don't actually know how that particular report came up with the $21, because there was also information coming from Canada's side. I should indicate, Mr. Chair, in Alberta, the official rate in Alberta is $11 an hour. So even that $21 doesn't have substance in Alberta. You know, so I'm not able to pinpoint what it is, but it took traction. I think, to answer the question, I think also, Honorable Edwards, I think we, mea culpa, the response was inadequate and definitely not timeless, because we only started coming, you know, responding publicly on the 9th of June, after the September 22nd and 3rd. So there's no question that, you know, our media response, you know, the thinking being that that will go away and we can, you know, manage it quietly, when all our firefighters, even as remote as they were, they had Wi-Fi, they could look at YouTube, they could watch ECNA, and they said to our manager, hey, there's the High Commissioner saying this. Even though the actual clip, she didn't say it, it was a voice at the back. But you can imagine what you say to a young employee, where the very person who said goodbye to you and said, welcome to come to Canada, you've seen the saying, you're going to get $21 an hour. You as a local manager, you don't have much standing against, you know, that argument. And we never understood the media challenge in dealing with it. So that's a fundamental lesson learned out of this. Digging exactly where they got, I'm not sure. What Anton Harbour has offered, obviously, we'll meet and see how we can, you know, repair whatever that. I think it doesn't help, as you know, to fight with the media. So even if they create some inaccuracies, Sunday Times, for example, you have to work with them somehow through it. Honorable Edwards, yes, the first deployment in 2015 was at 49. That was a different figure from what we're talking. I think in terms of covering all the costs, what you do, the flat rate, they say, look, here's the total what we estimate. Per head is this. And in our firefighters, you've got crew leaders with a little different, with strike team leaders, they say, flat rate, 172.88. That covers your mobilization costs, your insurance costs, the training costs, the camp that we had. The camp we had before, we had 394 firefighters from all over the country. They had to be transported to the camp, they had to be trained, they had to be fed, etc. All of that was thrown into the budget. So cut and divided by the number, 172.88. That's the flat rate. It's called the flat rate. As you see in the invoice, we get to say, that's the flat rate. Where does $50 come from? And Chair, you also raised that particular question. I think we use as a guideline the SARS income tax, the earnings, overseas earnings that are tax-free. When any official goes abroad, we have what's called the S&T allowance. In the case of Canada, if I'm remembering correctly at that time, it said at $167 a day. But that is for your accommodation, for your food, everything. And typically, if you remove those components, you will land up with $50 a day. So we had some basis. In fact, if you look at 2015, 2016, we stayed at 50 because there was a significant appreciation of the rand. So you actually had more income from the 2 years. And if we went over that, we start getting into our tax indication. Now, most of our beneficiaries are not in the tax bracket. You know, so we try to keep it clean in that sense, and any surplus would go into to the program as such. The premium, Alberta. I would say, Chair, an honourable person, someone who has clearly worked in labour, sort of a long track record of obviously research the matter, is known to be a labour law expert. I think the pressures in the context of an elective conference, and maybe the advice, I mean, these firefighters came with a visa that says you're not allowed to leave the great labour market, yet she cited that we cannot have these people working below labour market rates. Right? There's no consideration that they still get their income domestically. And in the end, you'll see her gesture of goodwill was, as Comrade Mangwela says, quite problematic. He says, give them $21 an hour for the days they fought the fire. And it was more than the Canadians were getting. It's more than the Canadians were getting. So even there, it will create tension. Why are these overseas people coming here and getting $21 an hour when our prevailing rate is actually $11 an hour? So clearly that was an attempt to try and placate a situation where there was this kind of incorrect information out in the media. Yes, it has created precedent, although we have set up our firefighters, and there's a lot of regrets, because I don't think their end game was to get the $21 an hour. Obviously, they see the report, they would like to get more. But if properly explained and by sort of conviction and ability convinced them that this is not part of any deal, they would have wanted to go on. In fact, many of them have said they would prefer to continue with the experience of firefighting than get this $21. As it turned out, the fire was turning. There was not really that need for the international assistance. And so the precedent will be with us, but I think that's why I said that one of our lessons is we would need to have a very serious sit down with anybody who employs us, what the terms and conditions of it. In this case, we had them sign an addendum to the contract, but I think we need to understand we're also employing the unskilled or formerly unemployed people, the ability to comprehend the simple document to sign in, compared to the High Commissioner on TV saying something different according to them, was a no-win situation. So it does point to the need for us to do much more in terms of preparing them and getting an agreement in terms of what we're doing. I don't believe it's a lost cause. I think our firefighters appreciate the opportunity to do this overseas deployment criticism. I just think the odds were stacked against the management the way this thing unfolded in this particular case. I can comment just briefly on the management fees, and the DA might want to take it further. That 11% was prior to the current contract. It was a previous contract, and the current level of payment to the implementing aid is based on a multi-year contract. Those were short-term contracts that we were implementing before the tender was through. Honourable Mangwela, I'm sure DA will speak a bit more to the model. I think one thing we need to talk to which doesn't come across, I think through this process we've constructed a firefighting force which has serviced this country across all the provinces. But we don't fully appreciate, we haven't reported fully on the transformation in the lives of our firefighters. Of our 375 managers in the program, 197 are former firefighters. Ms. Labati here is now the general manager, the ground operations manager in Mpumalanga, former firefighter. Right. So we have incredible stories to tell about what this has transformed people's lives. Discipline, we've had a social impact study where firefighters say, look, the discipline we've learned has changed how we raise our kids. The fact that many of our female firefighters are single parents, they're able to put their children into creche. And that's a very important step of breaking out of cycles of poverty. You know? So I think there's lots more to the model that is not just simply the firefighting, the prevention of fire, the social transformation that it represents. I think we're very proud. Many of our firefighters have gone into government service, police, into conservation agencies, into municipalities. We've got, in Zurelo, they had rangers. I think the recruitment was 25, 11 was from working on fire, four of them women.
So we've got a very proud record of bringing about transformation. On the legislation, I'll leave it to Zia to talk to. Chair just himself, I think, you know, there should be a phone call. interrupted the issue I was dealing with a flat rate.
What is that?
Sorry. The formula. As I said, the $50 comes from the solid rate. The flat rate, as I said, is intended to cover everything else. You know, all the costs of the whole program. And yes, our communication failure to separate out the flat rate because the media was hold of it. And, you know, by that time, it's like, how do you get 172 a day and pay 50? You know, there was no talk about how do you transport them, how do you fly them, how do you train them, all the kind of costs which we have. And Honourable Edwards, the answer to your question may lay into a page. I don't have the numbers. It's got a title, Audited Expenditure on International Deployment. Okay, so if you look at Canada 2, those are the estimates. Those are the actual costs that will derive from the invoice that we put. Okay, so it is broken down in a sense in terms of what is deployed. And this has been submitted to audit. So these figures that they've got here is an estimate because we don't have the revenue at this point in time. And then, lastly, I might just say in terms of the oversight, but we would love to have the portfolio committee come visit us, particularly our graduation ceremonies, when we have our leadership, our crew leaders emerging. Those are moments where you really see the kind of social transformation happening. And I think we definitely extend the invitation to all our crew leaders, graduation crew, to come and see what happens to the people.
Chair, let me do a few of the questions. I think maybe just to follow up on the one question by Honourable Edward. Where did it come from? We have the same situation in the country when it relates to economic wages. As I was thinking through a few of the experiences I wanted to share, we had a team of workers on one of the working poor programs on the Southern Cape, where you have grape farmers and apple farmers. At the time, that was like 5-6 years ago, they were paying about 25 rands or 20 rands per day as a farmer to the labor. Our EPWP wages were around between 30 and 35 rands per day. So one, we have the EPWP framed on the basis of that we're not following the labor laws. We have an exemption. There's an interim determination that gives them, and there is a determination in terms of what is the range. And then geographically, you still have to align so that you don't attract people away from the formal employment. Those are the difficulties, and we've had very difficult labor disputes in the country on that, but those were very much prevalent when we started the program. And less now, today, than I would say 15 years ago when the program was started. And I imagine if I was in Canada and I hear that somebody is earning far less than me and there are labor laws that are applicable there, you can decide that. And it would, I foresee how it happened. People talked and then somebody else then said. And so we may not have been, or the teams may not have been ready then to deal with that situation at that point in time. So we needed to have prepared the ground, both in terms of the authorities there understanding this framework, because it doesn't exist in Canada. It's a South African formula. So that is where I think it comes from. Secondly, I thought I should also reflect for in terms of the question raised by Honorable Mark Kuben on partly the precedent, but also more the model. Ideally, again, this is an area where the model has failed us, I can say, because if these were government employees, they would not have gone there because there's no agreement, formal agreement. But because we have an implementing agent that is involved in those negotiations, not directly us, when we were catching this and wanting the train to stop, we couldn't stop it because partly those are the concerns that need to be raised up front. If there is something that happens there, we're thinking of an accident. What would be the kind of thing? And so I would say the key message for us as government, if this was a public entity, I would have had a revenue strategy that is approved up front by the department. And the CFO would have looked at where the money would come from, what are the commercial activities, and then have that engagement with Treasury up front to then put in place specific parameters. So in this area we are experimenting. This is a novel or an area of untested water. So there's lessons that we've learned, and I think they will reinforce how we then engage in future. Or else we then say no deployment of EPWP staff internationally. That we can also arrive at. But that's something that we have to clear now up front. They cannot have another deployment in any country until we have confirmed what then those agreements are and what would be the instruments that we use up front to communicate. This is the type of a program. Yes, there's firefighting, but these are social issues and socio-economic matters that we're dealing with in South Africa versus the other country. And in fact, I do recall Dr. Preston, a few years ago, there was a study undertaken on EPWP, on Working for Water program in South Africa, as an international study that was raising a whole host of questions around the socio-economic approach to dealing with invasive species and so on. And we may take some of the findings from that study to inform the model in terms of how we improve on it going forward. My last comment, Chair, would relate to the legislation. Again, I think when these programs started, environmental affairs always, and even in underwater affairs at the time, water and sanitation, we had little resources coming to conservation, very much limited resources. And this was a novel way of highlighting the link between environment and contribution to socio-economic activities, which was not there before. We were just doing only the enforcement in parks and whatever, nothing outside. So this was something that was tested for the different programs. But maybe now we are at a point where maybe trade, we should then be asking the question, what is more permanent in the features of this program? Can they be financed in a manner that is not then EPWP? And then look at what are the other new opportunities. And those are the next steps, because I think we have got enough lessons over the 10, 15 years of the existence of the different streams of the program. So I think that is a food for thought. So partly, I would say, in the law reform aspect, the Biodiversity Act requires that we need to strengthen and make some amendments to enable firefighting requirements for conservation purposes, which is something that we still have to take for.
Which is an area that probably the department must look at with a view to coming to the committee to say what is the way forward.
Mm-hmm.
Because I know that fighting, there is a legislation that is being administered by DAF on firefighting, which I see there is an attempt to amend it. CAP is not saying that's before. So they are sitting with that legislation which makes provision for firefighting capacity, response, and all of those things. So if we are approaching this thing from an angle of fire diversity, we then need to come back and formalize that. Because it is an anomaly that the legislation is sitting with this department, which makes provision for this capacity that we are having now. And then we are performing part of the function of that, but there is almost nothing which is enabling other than an assumed function out of biodiversity management. So it's something that I think we must come back to. Then maybe the department must urgently then look into this. Because, well, I don't want to venture into asking. Because questions can be asked about this thing. Remember, as a government department, anything that you do, you must be empowered to do whatever you're doing by the station. Because that is the starting point. So if there are ambiguities around that, you must correct that. We appreciate the capacity. But we are spending, how much are we spending? It's more than 600 million on a function which there is not sufficient delegation by legislation from a push like that. So I'm saying, DG, let's finalize, let's come back to it and then probably utilize this. I don't know whether you can utilize or establish your own process of getting legislative endorsements for the function that you are performing currently and for which you are spending a lot of money on it. Now, I must say, look, I may have been distracted by the phone call. but at least even when there was a second opportunity for me to be clarified on this justification for $50 per day versus $178 that the program was receiving, I must say, I'm not sufficiently convinced, you see. I'm not yet convinced that there is a sufficient basis for that. When any program which is not a profit making program get this kind of ratios, it is very worrying. Because when you deploy workers get paid $50 out of the 172, and the rest goes to the cost of deployment, mobilization, flights, and so forth. And then almost 1.7 at the end of the 6-day deployment, is it 1.7 or 1.8? 1.7 goes towards management fee. That becomes, as far as
sufficient basis for concerns raised even in the media for this, because how do you reconcile that? Because normally in the normally in situation where you employ, because the money that you are getting is directly as a result of the deployment of the people. Without those workers, they would not be getting this amount. So surely we must look at a different model of international deployment. We must. That will cater for a different remuneration regime than the current one program. We have to do that, Mr. Abrams, because you pay me 50, you get out of my services, you get more. You get more than 100, and I only get 50. Because that is what it amounts to. That is not a, it's not something that you can justify. Some of us will put some activist background. When you approach things like this, you really see that really there is some level of exploitation, which is provided for by the law, because you are treating this as part of APWP. But there's a lot of money that accrues as a result of the labor that the skill that we are making available to the Canadians. So I'm not sufficiently convinced. Probably we might need to have a different engagement. I would say that before we get into the next deployment, let's look at this thing properly, so that we don't communicate a perception out there that we're exploiting our people. EPWP is a government program that is intended to serve as to create some employment opportunities, because we are responding to a major crisis that is facing our country of unemployment. But when you do an international deployment and you get so much profit out of that deployment, that becomes a different story altogether. It no longer accords with what the EPWP is supposed to do. Out of the deployment for 6 days, you get 1.6 million, and the rest then goes to the employees. I think that is something that we really need to look at when we do international deployment. My own proposal, which we have not really discussed it, is to say, can we come up with a different remuneration regime for the workers? Make sure that they sign, negotiate, and sign before they go, so that we don't have these problems going forward. The other thing, I think it's only better before the next deployment, when the Canadians request the assistance of South Africa working on fire. There must be that government to government agreement, even if it may be interim for that particular deployment, because when you do the deployment and there is no agreement between the two governments, you create a problem. So before the next thing comes, I think it's better that agreement must be in place. If it is something that is urgent and require our citizens, we must come up with an interim one, so that we don't get embarrassed like that. But I think generally, Mr. Abrams, there must be thorough preparation for deployment.
including intensive discussion with the workers, sign agreements before they leave, so that they understand also the implications of the agreement. But I would still say the remuneration must be different, because it's a different purpose altogether. So that is that, one of the members. I think we'll do the oversight. We will come and visit the working on fire. Working for fire.
On fire.
Working on fire.
Yeah, but it's written here, working for fire.
Working for fire.
So working on fire. So we'll do the oversight, and then I'll particularly be glad if we can also find some time to interact with the workers who have through this experience from Canada. Why did they have to do that and all of those things? But it's something that is part of learning from the Canadian experience. Anyway, we are done.
Okay.
Want to say something?
Yeah, I want to say, Chair, thank you for that summary and the issue that we must just remember, which is where I think as a department we are struggling. We were in one department, and water and environmental affairs, and it used to be water and trees and forestry. Indigenous forests, of most of them, have already been transferred to environmental affairs, because that's not quite the function now per se of DAF. But those things are still in transition. As I indicated, DAF is engaging on law reform. We are also making law reform. Similarly, with DMR, when the matter you raised around mine rehabilitation is going to squarely be on similar, the work that is done by DMR whilst we are finalizing the legislation around the financial provision. So decisions are made there, not fully with us. So but I will clarify those, Chair, when we come on the matters of legislation and what is remaining between us and DAF, and to a greater extent, what are the linkages between us, water and sanitation, and also DMR. So there is biodiversity, there is also other matters around environmental protection that are still, that require cleaning up in law, which is part of what I understood. There was going to be joint sittings of this committee with those key portfolio committees, so that we clear those matters going forward. We have engaged even on the forestry legislation, the draft bill with DAF. The ministers have reached an agreement, so we have to share with you exactly what the agreement entails and what are the things in the transitional arrangements that are still.
That's exactly my point, and yes, probably we must use that process. You see, DG, before you do something, you must be empowered by the law to do it. And that's basically what I am raising, and I think the committee is raising that. To say, we are not saying that you are doing something wrong, we understand the transition, but we are saying, let's try and come up with something that will be able to address that. For instance, now that there is a process of trying to amend that law by DAF, you can then utilize that to make sure that as you amend the law, then there is that provision that is made to the government, especially when it relates to biodiversity. So that's all what I'm saying. But I understand that this macro
organization of the state.
Yeah, adjustment to the macro organization of the state. It does create some situation. Because sometimes it used to be environment and tourism, and then it was environment
it was environment, tourism, and fisheries.
And fisheries, and now it has changed.
We have ocean. Some
so
of the things are
no, that is properly understood. Just that as it goes forward, we must come up with something that will also make provision for that. But we would like to have a discussion on the working form.
Yes.
Because we might be very unfair to Mr. Abrams to hammer him on something that is applicable on all other programs. But we had to call him in now because your guys were in Canada, and we also had, when we issued a statement to say we are concerned, we didn't want to come up with any conclusive assertions. We just said we are concerned about what we are picking up. We will engage with you. Unfortunately, it was during the elections, and most members were not around in all of those things. So it took long before we engaged with ourselves. So maybe us as well, we might have contributed to the negative narrative in the media, I don't know. But we just expressed more concern also for us. But as I said, we will then have to have another closer session with yourself, especially on the formula that you are using on payment of the workers. Maybe something that you can clarify as you did for the meeting, but I think we need to follow up on that discussion. But thank you very much, honorable members. And working for fire. Working on fire. I see you brought the big game.
He's closing, he's going to go out to the press. Yeah, press thing.
Thank you.
should I create a folder for you?
I didn't want to do
Thank you.